from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. In this Forum Hour, Harvard behavioral economist Iris Bonet will join us in the studio. She argues that the key to overcoming gender bias is focus on organizations and not on individuals. And she suggests that companies adopt strategies like blind auditions and data-driven analysis to prevent unconscious bias from seeping into decision-making. She'll join us to talk about her new book, What Works, Gender Equality by Design, and that's next. After this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. And in this hour, we welcome Harvard behavioral economist Iris Bonet to this program, and she's here in the studio with us. She's former academic dean of the Kennedy School at Harvard, now directs the Women and Public Policy Program there. She's published a book on seeking and finding ways to diminish gender imbalance, especially in the workplace, and the book is titled What Works, Gender Equality by Design, and pleased to have you with us. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
This has been like things cluster together, as I was saying to Iris Bonet before we went on the air here. Yesterday, you may remember, we had Ellen Malcolm on, so we've been talking about gender here for the last couple of hours. But I want to get into maybe a little psychology first with you, because I think it's appropriate to call you somewhat of an acolyte of Daniel Kahneman. And what a lot of this work that you've done has to do with is unconscious reflexes and how they make for bias.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. The unconscious bias, sadly enough, is with all of us. And unconscious bias is part of a larger family, as you just alluded to, of biases that hold us back and don't allow us to make optimal decisions.
And I should mention that Daniel Kahneman is a well-known economist who works on human behavior a great deal. He's been on this program, and he is a Nobel laureate in economics. A lot of this goes back to that, I think it started with the Boston Symphony back in the 1970s. They would have auditions for getting into the symphony, and they would have a curtain up. This was for racial as well as gender purposes, I believe. You couldn't see the person's color. You couldn't see what gender they were. You just had to go on the musicianship.
Yeah, blind evaluations are a very powerful tool to help our minds focus on actual performance rather than whether somebody looks the part. And so it should work for all different demographic characteristics, whether this is gender or race or anything else that we care about, including body size. I mean, there's also research suggesting that we discriminate against people with certain body sizes.
We discriminate in so many areas, but of course your area, your bailiwick, is gender. And I'm interested in how you can really assess the nature of changing behavior. First of all, in terms of biases and gender, it's hard work to change behavior. In fact, you pretty much, I don't say you throw up the towel, but you say, you know, like a lot of these diverse training kind of programs, which have cost millions and millions of dollars, almost can't really even measure to what effect or what good they've done in terms of changing individuals.
In many ways, that was a somewhat disappointing finding in my book, that I really went out there and tried to understand what impact these diversity training programs are having. And the overarching finding is that, A, we don't really know. We don't measure enough. And B, if we do measure, we either find that they have no impact, or in one study that looked at correlations, meaning whether a company had a diversity training program or not was correlated with, related to the workforce of that company. And they also found that that correlation basically was not existent. So yes, diversity training programs sadly don't seem to be the answer to unconscious bias.
Well, what may be the answer, again, according to your research, is changing the environment, changing the organization. You have a really useful illustration that with Google and what happened with, you know, employees, for example, women employees in childbirth.
Yeah. So Google, of course, is at the forefront of measurement. And in one chapter, that is kind of my big message, that don't just throw money at the problem, but try to understand what's broken. And Google, like other companies, has done a very good job bringing data, big data, into people management. In fact, it's now called people analytics. And I think I can safely predict that this is going to completely revolutionize our HR management. And yes, so what Google found was that women were actually not more likely to leave, but it was young mothers who were more likely to leave. leave. And then being Google, they could do something about it and increase both maternity and parental leave.
Well, since you mentioned people analytics, I want to maybe get in that with you a little bit, because there's a study by someone out of Wharton, Janet Fanning Madden, and essentially she said women stockbrokers weren't performing as well, but they were getting worse accounts to begin with.
No, that's right. And I think what was powerful in her research is that she had access to an almost unprecedented data set, really understanding what the stockbrokers were doing, what their accounts looked like, how much money they made, etc. And she did find something that is now called performance support bias, that these stockbrokers actually started out with worse performing accounts. But this is not just a Wall Street phenomenon. MIT, in fact, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, was one of the first universities finding that its female faculty didn't get a fair share in terms of support that included office size, laboratories, support staff, resources. They've now rectified that. But again, being MIT, it was completely data-driven, including using a measuring rod and going from office to office to measure.
We're talking with Iris Bonnet, and she's Director of Women and Public Policy at Harvard's Kennedy School and also the author of What Works, Gender Equality by Design. What made you write this book?
So I first was a behavioral economist who was not particularly interested in gender, I have to confess, but really focused on helping people and organizations make better decisions and trying to help them de-bias how they did things. And then the dean of the Kennedy School at the time, David Elwood, asked me whether I would want to be the director of this research center, the Women in Public Policy Program. And it took me actually about a year to bring my past together with my future and realize that unconscious bias is just a subcategory of the bigger family of biases, and that I could use many of the tools that I had employed before to help people, organizations, and society make better decisions to gender equality.
You took your kid to daycare, though, and realized, I mean, and people sometimes do get concerned. They see a male daycare worker, they think pedophilia and all these kinds of things, but a lot of gender bias is involved in that. I mean, like kindergarten teachers, even, many people see, and they're supposed to be women in their heads. So if there's a male kindergarten teacher, something goes off.
Yeah, sadly, that's my own story that you are sharing here, and I also write about it in the book. To my amazement, I have to say, I fell into the same trap that most everyone falls into, and that seeing is believing. And if we don't see male kindergarten teachers or female engineers, for that matter, we don't naturally associate those jobs with men and women, respectively. So when I did take our son to a Harvard daycare center, one of the first teachers, in fact, was male, and I thought that this was the end of the world.
Well, in fact, those biases go in so many deep levels. Men are associated with careers still. I mean, even though people will use a rhetoric to say I'm not sexist and maybe even feel very relinquished of that kind of bias, but women are associated with families. It still holds true,
yeah,
doesn't it?
No, that is true. And more generally, we talk about a leadership bias for women, that for women, it's very, very hard to be both perceived as competent and likable at the same time. Because when they appear competent, then they defy some of the gender norms that you just described that go with family and warmth and caring and compassion. And yeah, so that is hard, makes it harder for women to climb up the career ladder.
And it's the old stereotype that still holds true. If men are aggressive, it's okay, it's competitive. If women are, you know, they get the B word often.
Yes, yes. There's actually an interesting little case study that came out of Silicon Valley. A colleague of mine, Kathleen McGinn, wrote a case study on Heidi Roizen, who is a venture capitalist in the Valley, a few years back. And it was kind of a typical case study that many of our viewers or listeners will have encountered in their life. And she described how she built her enterprises, ran her VCs, etc. And then a few years later, some colleagues used the same case study but replaced the protagonist's name by Howard. And then they gave half of their student the name with the protagonist being called Howard and the other half with the protagonist being called Heidi. And they found what many, many other researchers have also found, that is that we think that both Heidi and Howard did a good job and are competent, but we don't like Heidi.
Well, recently I had an occasion to observe someone who's, I suppose you could call more traditional-minded, meet a couple that I know, and the man is not the earner. He's the home care, child care And this fellow said, well, what do you do? You know, I mean, people always ask that question. It's sort of annoying, really. can be annoying. But he said, well, I'm a house husband. And he looked, this older guy looked at him like he had just stepped off of Jupiter or Neptune or something like that. I mean, it was just so alien to his way of thinking. And I thought, even in this stage of what we see on television and the movies and so forth, the idea of a house husband was just set off something that in terms of associations, he couldn't even compute.
Yeah, bias really is about being counter-stereotypical. So gender bias really is not about women or men, but it is about counter-stereotypical individuals. So if you are in a role where typically the other sex is the dominant part, then people will experience the kind of bias that you just described, your friend experienced. And of course, your friend doesn't have the benefit of the curtains, you know, of the blind auditions. They were so powerful because they helped our minds do the right thing without our minds having to be changed. And they increased the likelihood that we now have about 40% women in our major orchestras, when in the 70s we had only 5%. But again, I think it's an important study for me personally because it demonstrates not just the power of unconscious bias, but also the power of a little bit of design and technology.
That's really what your book is about, is, you know, taking institutions and designing them differently, but also your own life and making these attitudes change to some extent by organizational effect on behavior rather than, you know, saying I'm going to have to take charge here and use my own free will and all this. In fact, getting back to that diversity training, it doesn't haven't there been some studies that show that people are more apt to see sexism in other people than in themselves once they go through those kind of training?
Yeah. So some colleagues of mine have actually tried different debiasing strategies to help our minds get things right more easily. And most of them, in fact, haven't been working very well. So a very easy one is just awareness. So sadly enough, just by being aware of these gender biases against male kindergarten teachers or female engineers, that doesn't protect us from being sexist tomorrow or even in an hour from now. But there are some more elaborate techniques that do a little bit better. And some of them kind of do look at, for example, taking someone else's perspective. And, you know, can that help walk in your counterpart's shoes?
Empathy, essentially.
Yes, empathy. And that has done a little, but not that much. And interestingly enough, what they found was exactly what you described, that people were more likely to realize, oh, yeah, bias exists in the world. But now I better understand that you must be biased and it isn't me. The one technique that is most promising, so I don't want to leave our listeners kind of completely hanging in the air. The one technique that has been most promising is kind of playing devil's advocate with yourself. But that's kind of pretty elaborate, where you consciously question your assumptions all the time and why you might be wrong. And you literally force yourself to write down the 5 reasons why you might be wrong. But then, of course, it's a little
more methodical than everyday interactions.
Pretty elaborate, yes.
Yeah. It brings us to the whole subject of what's called moral licensing, which is a fascinating subject to me. The idea that people do good deeds and it makes them feel more virtuous and then they're apt to do something that's not so virtuous afterward. It's a compensatory type of behavior. For example, somebody says, I voted for Barack Obama. I voted for an African-American, so now, you know, I'm not necessarily going to be open to being, well, less prejudiced or less biased.
Yeah, sadly enough, that is a kind of relatively new finding. And I do think we have to still take the evidence a bit with a grain of salt because it's such a young field of research. But it does suggest that maybe we do experience some backlash when we make people be more inclusive than they kind of do want to be naturally. And one of the research studies has, in fact, not looked at gender or race at all, but at a very different domain, at people's eating behavior. So do we compensate for our virtuous lunches when we focus on salads with a chocolate chip cookie in the afternoon? And yes, that's exactly what they found. So there is reason to be concerned that, you know, being good here might lead to being worse someplace else. At the same time, honestly, I don't think it can keep us from fixing the problem.
Since you mentioned eating, let's talk about fixing a problem. You discovered that if you have a plate as opposed to the food pyramid, you have better effect.
Yes. So, you know, that's really not rocket science. But in this country, we have been using a pyramid for a very long time to help all of us understand what food choices would be good for us. But sadly enough, or pretty Obviously enough, we don't eat of pyramids, but we eat of plates. And so the new description and the new image now is in fact a food plate, and it has a little cup and silverware on the right and left-hand side. And it's immediately intuitive to people whether they eat too much pasta or too little veggies, because that's what they see on their plates.
Some of this is so obvious. I mean, you write about, for example, the fact that gender bias can be changed and turned around just by putting portraits and pictures up on walls. And also, we think about things like littering and smoking and mm-hmm. the effect of just shaming that can actually change behavior.
Yeah. I mean, you talk about changing norms, and that's certainly a very promising avenue of research where we actually quite know a bit. So let me start with the role models. I mean, role models are very important, and of course, they are even more important in the real flesh. But even portraits can play a role. And I have to say, sadly enough, that at the Kennedy School, it's only about 10 years ago that we realized that of the portraits on our walls, exactly zero were of women. And that's at a school where 50% of our students are female. We've changed that since, but it took somebody, a colleague of mine, actually, Jenny Mansbridge, to realize that something was broken. And it does matter. So real research, so this is just a story, but real research can show that what students see while they take tests affects their performance in the test.
We're talking to Iris Bonnet. She's professor and director of Women in Public Policy at Harvard, and she's also the author of What Works, Gender Equality by Design. She'll be speaking at the Mechanics Institute Library this evening, a conversation with Anne Spaulding. And let's talk about at 6 p.m., excuse me, and let's talk about the workplace some more, because a lot of people will go through a process where they self-evaluate, mm-hmm. self-appraisal, especially in the workplace. What can I do better and what are my goals and so forth? Women, again, the biases work differently for them. Men are often more confident and put forth a self that they feel more confident about, whereas women who are perhaps, one could argue, as you do to some degree. You mentioned Jennifer Lawrence, for example, feeling that she doesn't want to ask for a higher salary on a movie because she doesn't want to appear pushy or whatever, or snotty. There again are the biases that go against the self.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Jennifer Lawrence was dealing with what we discussed earlier, and that is the competence likability dilemma, that by being assertive and competent, she feared she might be perceived as less likable. But you're right, there is a lot of evidence suggesting that women are less self-confident than men. And one important question for us is, what does this mean in terms of leveling the playing field, if in fact men and women come with these differences? And for performance appraisals, I think a very simple insight is that people should not share their self-evaluations with their supervisors before the supervisors make up their own minds. Why? Because any number, not just in performance appraisals, but also in negotiations, any number that I throw at you will anchor your judgment. So they serve as an anchor, and you will be unable to assess information objectively. And that's why we're suggesting to not share self-evaluations with supervisors and let them come up with their own evaluations.
You also suggest that there ought to be gender-neutral language, that sometimes the lack of gender-neutral language in terms of job positions that are open and so forth can have certainly a real serious impact. But I was interested in like interviewing people for jobs. I got the sense that you were recommending use the same question and be certain you phrase it in a way that doesn't show gender bias. That could be very boring, though, couldn't it?
Yes, but even more importantly, I'm kind of suggesting not to interview at all. And that is going to be shocking to our listeners. But the interview is probably the most overrated instrument that we're using to evaluate people's performance. And there's no evidence suggesting that interviews do a good job in predicting someone's future performance. So yes, I'm happy to talk about how we can make interviews better. But more importantly, it is to think about alternatives to interviews, such as, for example, work sample tests. Again, this is not rocket science, not a big surprise that when I hire a research assistant and ask him or her to do a little data analysis and write up a short report, that gives me a better sense of how well the person will perform in the future than anything that I could ever ask in an interview.
You're also, I mean, as a teacher, I'm a teacher also, you write about how you get a very different response from students if you put them into groups. I've noticed this too. I don't know if it's partially concern about the intimidation of a professor or whatever, or just at ease, being greater at ease talking to each other, but there's certainly a marked and dramatic difference. How does that translate into the workplace, or does it?
Yeah, no, it does translate into the workplace as well. But let me, in fact, start with school environments first. If women, and not just women, I mean, people with certain cultural backgrounds, certain nationalities are less self-confident and less used to speaking up, then we do them a disservice if in our classrooms we just have people in large, large groups of 80 or 90 or 150, and some people will just not raise their hands. And so, yes, I do try to assign people to smaller groups, and that often gives them the self-confidence to then speak up in public. But then, of course, the question is, so how do you form these smaller groups? And that leads me now to the workplace as well. Is diversity in these teams also important? And yes, it is. And one thing that I have started doing actually relatively recently, I'm not forming any skewed groups anymore. I don't want a woman or a man to be the only one in a group. And so some groups, if I don't have an even share of men and women, for example, in my class, some groups might end up being completely homogenous. But there's a lot of evidence that being the only one leads to tokenism.
Let me go back to the workplace. So Germany and Europe, are they ahead of the United States when it comes to gender equality in the workplace?
Well, it depends on how you look at it. So certainly European countries, in particular Norway and more recently Germany as well, have introduced quotas for their corporate boards. And in that sense, the fraction of women on the corporate boards is increasing more quickly than in the US. I don't think that quotas are on the table in this country. And so my recommendation for the US is, in fact, take inspiration from the United Kingdom, which was able to increase its fraction of female directors on corporate boards from about 12% in 2011 to more than 25% now without relying on quotas, but in fact benefiting from behavioral design.
Our guest, if you've just joined us, is Iris Bonnet, and again, she is professor and director of Women in Public Policy at Harvard's Kennedy School and author of What Works, Gender Equality by Design. Coming up on a break here, but what do you tell people in terms of their biases just in their life, in organizing their life to a better degree to be less biased in gender?
Yeah, well, that's a tough question. I think most importantly, I think that's actually quite liberating. I am trying to tell people that this is not about pointing fingers. This is not about them, but this is about how our minds work. And that's also why I share my story about the kindergarten teacher, because it is important for all of us to realize that this is about all of us. And we tend to put people into boxes and we tend to want to see patterns and the kind of patterns that we're normally used to. But yes, people should think hard about, for example, the kinds of books their kids read, the kind of television programs their kids watch, what they see and the role models they see can quite literally transform what they think is possible for themselves.
And then we could do a whole program on just with respect to relationships between, talking about not necessarily even just men and women, but relationship in terms of the biases that enter. I'm going to have you enter the program, that is you who are listening, by extending the phone number to you and inviting you to call us and share your thoughts and join the conversation. You can do that toll-free at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with behavioral economist Iris Bonnet. We're talking about ways to achieve gender equality in the workplace and really to do something about gender bias. And if you have some ideas and some thoughts about this or some experiences that you would perhaps like to bring to the fore here, we do welcome your involvement in the program. And again, you can join us at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Iris Bonnet's book is called What Works, Gender Equality by Design, and she'll be speaking 6 o'clock this evening at the Mechanics Institute Library in San Francisco, and she'll be in conversation with Anne Spaulding. But in the meantime, let me go to some of your comments here. A listener writes, if the genders are equal, why must workplaces be changed to accommodate the different needs of women? A recent and recognizable example of how gender differences play out was when Bernie Sanders told Hillary Clinton not to interrupt. He was accused of sexism. Would he not have equally told a male rival not to interrupt him?
So let's go back to the example of orchestras. I do think it's important to let data speak. In fact, that is one of my missions in writing this book, that we should think about gender the way we think about inflation or unemployment and let real evidence speak for itself. So I do think that evidence on blind evaluations from orchestras is quite significant, in that only blindness helped orchestra directors and orchestra selection committees to, in fact, see the talent in people who didn't look the part.
Well, hear the talent.
Yeah, exactly. No, that more likely, exactly, hear the talent rather than see whether somebody looked the part. And it increased the likelihood that women advanced the future round by 50%. So I do think that's kind of important for us to, even though there are, of course, always stories where bias works in some unexpected ways, data is an important guiding principle for us.
Let me read one more comment, then I'll go to your calls, and you can place comments on our website, again, at kqed.org/forum. Tinu writes, just yesterday, Forum had a guest who said if there were more women in government, there would be more cooperation. That was Ellen Malcolm of Emily's List. Half the time, we don't want any bias. The other half, we do. How do we reconcile this?
Yeah, excellent question. Again, I think we have to kind of go elsewhere. We have to go where we have good data. So, in fact, India was the first country to introduce quotas for its local village heads. And that happened in 1993. And it's so interesting from an evidence point of view, because the third of the villages was picked randomly out of a hat. And so researchers could examine what difference really makes. And what they found was that women weren't necessarily more cooperative per se, but they did provide more public goods than their male counterparts. And the public goods they provided were the public goods that women in particular care about, which happens to be water in India, which also was good for development. So that's actually the best place to look for us to understand whether gender difference in politics would in fact matter. And researchers have been following that experiment now for more than 20 years and found a number of other interesting effects. So the first one is that the first woman has a very hard time. The first woman in office has a very hard time overcoming these gender biases.
Yeah, in fact, I referenced Senator Susan Collins of Maine yesterday, who said when she ran for the Senate, there was more concern about what she was wearing, first of all. But then when she became a part of the Senate, which is mainly dominated by men, it was a men's club, and there was a lot that she had to go through just to be accepted. You may hear from some of our listeners, particularly reach out to listeners who may have experienced some gender bias. Male manicurists, for example, or male nurses come to mind, but even women in, who are out there doing construction or police work or whatever. In the meantime, let's go to our callers. And we're going first to you, Leslie. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I work in high tech, so I'm very used to being the only woman in the room. I'm wondering if we're phrasing the discussion in a way that's gender biased in itself. For example, why don't we say that women are more authentic and more cooperative in conversation and interviews, so that it's not the male perspective of being more aggressive or more confident that wins, but the women's perspective of being more authentic?
I think about that semantic distinction. Iris Bonet?
Yeah, no. Thanks very much for your question, Leslie. I don't know whether we in fact find that women are more authentic than their male counterparts. In fact, sadly enough, often women aren't authentic because they fear backlash. And that's kind of what the Jennifer Lawrence story reminds us of.
Or they fear they have to behave like men.
I don't think
I mean, there are a lot of women, particularly in high executive positions, who feel, they've told me this on the air, you know, I've interviewed them, and they say, I feel like I have to, you know, show some testosterone here and that sort of thing.
Yeah, no. It certainly also shows in the clothes that women wear and that they feel like they have to fit in. And yes, here's the problem. So yes, it can be one strategy, but there's also very strong evidence that by behaving like men, for example, being assertive in negotiation, women will experience what we call social backlash, that they are punished for violating gender norms. So it's a really tough balance that women are striking here between fitting in, but at the same time not overdoing it.
I'm sure we'll hear from some more of our callers on this. And let me thank Leslie for her call and go to more calls. And we'll bring Rebecca on next. Rebecca, welcome.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a highly experienced female white engineer, and I've worked with over the past decades with groups of homogeneous foreign workers. it's been really difficult because although there have been some female engineers from overseas in those groups, whether Europe or Asia, as a white female engineer, I do stick out. And how do you address gender bias when there are women in the group, but they're not, like, lack of better words, westernized? I the fear of being too general, some women are possibly more subservient. Please, that's a generalization, but do you get what I'm saying? Due to their cultural norms, which they can, I don't know, maybe hide under the covers more, whereas someone who's more outspoken, although white engineer, highly skilled, kind of is the nail that sticks up and gets, you know, pounded down. Please comment on the cross-cultural differences.
A good example that comes to mind, if I may, Rebecca, is a woman executive I know who had to present to a lot of Japanese executives. And boy, there were some real cultural barriers there. I mean, the sense of a woman executive coming in and talking to these men was unprecedented to some degree.
Yeah. Well, thank you for your question, Rebecca. I think you point out two important things. One is that we also have to worry about what we now call intersectionality, right? We are defined not just by our gender, but we're also by our culture, by our race, by our nationality, lots of other things, I mean, including the fact that you are an engineer. And that certainly it can be true that you are in feeling like you are the only one, even though there are other women in the room, because these other women are so, so different from you. So you kind of are experiencing what I alluded to before, and that is tokenism, that you feel like you have to kind of carry the water here for women in your team and might not be able to rely on everyone else. Now, having said this, one thing that does give me hope when we have very diverse teams where kind of everyone is different from everyone else, we actually also find that people focus more on actual performance rather than people's demographic characteristics because there is no clear fault line. So, you know, there's a bit of hope here that maybe there could be some good news in the amount of diversity that you are experiencing.
Do you favor affirmative action for women?
I'm pausing here, and I'm pausing because I am a behavioral economist, and I would argue there are many more low-hanging fruit that we haven't yet explored and plucked before we even have to think about affirmative action. The evidence of affirmative action, I think, is a bit mixed. It has certainly increased the fraction of underrepresented groups very dramatically, as have quotas, and therefore has had extremely positive impacts on seeing, right? It changes who we see very, very quickly. So in that sense, I do favor affirmative action. My concern about affirmative action and quotas is that there's also good evidence that we will experience backlash, that people who benefit from affirmative action are experiencing backlash. And so that's, I think, the balance that we have to strike. But, you know, honestly, I don't think it's up to a behavioral designer to make that call. But this is almost a moral decision that we as a people have to make.
Looking at a couple of listener questions, and they kind of dovetail in a way. One listener says, would this approach work for racist relatives? And then another listener, Carla, says, unconscious bias affects so many people. On several occasions, I have shown up for contracts, and I could see in the eyes of the decision maker that they were judging me on the spot. In my opinion, they think she's overweight and therefore not a candidate for the job. Never mind the fact that I'm the one that shows up to work, rain, sleet, or snow, to do the job that I'm getting paid to do. People come in all shapes and sizes, judge me on my skill, not my dress size. So we're talking about race, gender. I mean, do the same kinds of solutions that you're working out apply?
Yeah. So excellent question. Thank you very much to both of these listeners. Many of the intervention that I discuss in the book do apply more generally. And certainly blind evaluations is something that I advocate for anyone who cares about benefiting from 100% of the talent pool. And that includes not knowing somebody's gender or race or name or body size or height for that matter. So, you know, some research, for example, has also shown that short men are discriminated against, as are overweight women. So it's a huge concern of mine. And I'm very, very happy to see that a number of tech firms, in fact, startups, have developed tools which make it easy for organizations to evaluate job candidates blindly. And so I think there's a lot of hope there. And what's beautiful about it is it's a win-win situation, which is a bit different from quotas or affirmative action. It's a win-win. It's better for the company. It's a smart thing to do because they want to hire the best talent and not the person who looks the part. And it's a win for all of us who feel that we haven't given a fair share, because we will actually get a job that we can accomplish and where we can thrive in.
I think Deborah Rohde, Stanford professor, law, did a study to show that people who are better looking also get bias in favor of them.
Yeah, we call this the beauty premium. And there's lots of research. In fact, Deborah has
I've never experienced this bias myself, of course.
I can see that, Michael.
I'm saying I wish I were a more handsome lad. But here's – just confirmed. Here's Devi, who tweets, as a house husband, I have faced bias from housewives. My kids have done well academically in sports and are empathetic. What drives women to think that men can't be good primary caregivers?
Yeah, sadly, the answer to that question is quite straightforward. As long as we don't see more men in those roles, these men will be perceived as violating gender norms and will experience some of the same bias that counter-stereotypical women in engineering or tech, for example, experience. So it is very, very sad. It is changing, though. So the Nordic countries, for example, have found less bias, in particular in house husbands, that they, because there's such many more men who stay at home and are the primary caregivers.
I'm going to go to more calls in just a moment, but here's a question from Ben. Have you seen a lowering of biases with younger generations? Do biases increase with age? Fact is, we keep hearing that millennials have much less racial discrimination than their parents, for example, but any kind of chronology here?
Excellent question, Ben. I think, sadly, the final verdict is still out because we see a number of things happening. So first of all, research has shown that gender bias, now in particular, kicks in between 4 and 6 years old. And that research has used wooden puppets and they had no sex. And one of the wooden puppets had kind of a grandstanding, powerful posture, and the other one was looking a bit weaker. And then if you ask for a four-year-old, what they look like, what they see, they will say, well, something like strong or weak or small and large. But if you ask a six-year-old, the girl and the boy will say the weak puppet is female and the strong puppet is male. So somehow in those early ages, gender stereotypes are being formed and then are reinforced by the books and the films that we watch. Now, it is true that we see changes in values and have been seeing actually changes in values in the last 30 years, in particular, interestingly enough, in particular among men, caring more about equality, being more inclusive, and of both men and women, but also of different racial groups. And I do think that's very encouraging. Most of them have not yet entered the workforce in large numbers. And it'll be interesting to see whether they change the labor market as well.
Iris Bonnet here with us in studio. Her book is What Works, Gender Equality by Design. And let me go to more of your calls. Arnold, welcome. You're on the air.
Yeah. Hi, Michael.
Hi.
During the 1980s, I was an executive at Xerox Corporation. And at Xerox, gender and ethnic opportunity and diversity were simply embedded in the culture. There were no quotas. There was no training. But when I was first interviewed, I was told that this would be part of my performance review, but in a nominal way, not in any strict numerical quota way. And if I I later came to discover that when I said, "Well, I'm sorry, but I'm just not getting applicants in the gender and ethnic diversity categories," I would be asked, "Well, what are you doing out in your professional field to help develop the talent pool in the pipeline?" And it's no accident that if you take a look at Xerox, that you'll see up and down the chain a great deal of ethnic and gender diversity.
Arnold, a lot of that has to do with Saul Linowitz, doesn't it? The culture that you are speaking
about.
Yes, Xerox? Yeah.
Yes, but it wasn't just Saul. I mean, he embedded it all the way up and down the chain, and it cascaded. and everyone paid attention to it.
No, it's good to hear.
But he was the origin.
Because we think about, I use the word Xerox something, and I realize how antiquated it sounds. I mean, you don't even think about Xeroxing anymore, but this is back in the 80s, and Linowitz was really ahead of the curve. How much can it be embedded in the culture, though, Iris Bonnet, when it's not there, and when you don't have it, the leadership really emphasizing it the way we're talking about in this context?
So thank you for your comment, Arnold, and sharing some hopeful news with our listeners. In fact, I fear that the bad news here is that it does require leadership from the top. What I liked about Arnold's comment was the embedding, right? Culture isn't just an amorphous concept that nobody knows what it's really about. But he described to us that culture translated into their practices and procedures and translated into thinking about goals and holding people accountable, translated into looking at your pipeline, are you going out to traditionally discriminated against groups? Are you finding colleges where some of these people might be more likely to go to school? So what is the work that you're actually doing? What kind of job advertisements do you pose? Do you use gendered language or do you use inclusive language? So I think that's a super important comment that we can learn from Arnold, that culture is not something abstract that happens in our minds, but translates into our practices and procedures.
Well, let me thank Arnold for that call. And a question from you, Harry. Welcome. You're on the air.
Thank you. I'm really interested in this topic because I would like to know, it's an area that I work in and I work in politics related to this area. I'd like to know how you define bias versus behavior and the impact of bias on behavior. Are we trying to change biases or are we trying to change behavior? And also, what evidence do you have that publication and evidence and research changes our behavior and our biases?
Yeah. Thanks very much, Harry. So there are a number of ways in which we can measure bias. One thing that you might want to do is go to harvardimplicit.edu and you can measure your own biases. And I can safely predict that about 90% of our listeners will find that they are sexist and racist and many ists that they don't want to be. Because again, sadly, seeing is believing. So that's one way to measure bias. But being an economist, I am, in fact, much more interested in behaviors. And what I do in the book, I almost exclusively focus on behaviors that are measured in an experimental way. And this is going to take a moment, but I think it's worth talking about it because so often evidence is kind of oversold. And I'm a bit on a mission to let good evidence speak on this question. So good evidence means that we, in fact, learn from the natural sciences and ran an experiment, a randomized controlled trial, where we give some people the treatment and other people the placebo. So we literally have a treatment group and a control group. And then we measure what difference makes. And that's how we measure our interventions to see whether they increase, for example, the fraction of traditionally underrepresented people hired or promoted in a certain company.
What about the Harvard test that you mentioned, though? You say most people will find that they have some disposition of being racist or sexist. What about the bias of the test makers? I mean, they're biased on racial biases or certainly gender biases in many ways, aren't they?
Oh, I mean, the test takers, when they took the test the first time, I mean, one of the makers of this test is Mazarin Banaji, who is a professor of psychology at Harvard. And she will talk about that she is as biased as everyone else. I mean, what the test basically does...
No, that's what I'm asking, though. I'm saying the people who actually make the test have biases in terms of what they believe or what they subjectively think reflects bias in other people. I mean, you were talking about the fact that you don't often see your biases in yourself, but you can see it in other people. Mm. I'm really asking you how infallible these kinds of tests are.
Oh, right. So, you know, I think that's hard to know. With this particular test, given that it has been taken by millions of people, we have now a number of studies, not in the hundreds, but I think in the dozens at this point, which have been trying to see whether the answers that you give in the test, whether they are correlated with the kinds of behaviors that we can measure. And so that is, you know, one way to kind of get a sense of the validity of the test. So one experiment, for example, looked at a job application where somebody applied to become a research assistant and was actually done on academics. And these academics had previously taken an implicit bias test. And the question was, for a laboratory manager position where a man and a woman applies, who is going to be more likely to be hired, given that they both have the exactly same qualifications. Now, the study found that these academics were more likely to prefer the men for the laboratory manager position, but importantly, that decision was related to their unconscious bias. So that's kind of how we get a better sense of, does it measure anything that's relevant for real life?
Let me bring another caller on, and we'll go to you, Paul. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call, and I wanted to appreciate this discussion, but I wanted to offer a couple things as somebody who's kind of doing a study on engineers in the Valley around race. One thing is the notion of the blind applicant, the blind process for applying for jobs. It's a great idea, and what I'm concerned about is it kind of kicks the problem down the road a little bit, because so you hire these people with a blind admission, a blind applicant test, and they still land in a culture that could be somewhat corrosive for them. And so what we end up doing is we don't correct the culture in the companies writ large. The other point I wanted to make was around the pipeline. If you look at the numbers, colleges are producing, for instance, by way of gender, colleges are producing a reasonable number, whatever that means, of women engineers. My question is, why aren't they all being absorbed into these companies? And when we talk about the pipeline problem, then we're turning this into a deficit model that is laying the fault onto the, if it's women or Latinos or Black people, when in fact what we know is there is biases in these processes. And then the last piece was just, I think this is a great discussion. I hope the Valley will be a little more patient, because it is changing behaviors, and behaviors take much longer to change than just hiring more numbers. And I'll take my response off air.
All right, Paul, thank you for that. We'll go back to Iris Bonnet.
Well, lots of good observations and questions, Paul. Let me start with your last one, the behaviors. I think we are completely in line that we actually have to focus on behaviors. It's hard work. It won't come from today to tomorrow. But we have changed many behaviors in this country. So there used to be a time when smoking was the default. And in a generation, we have completely changed those norms around smoking. The same is true for littering. There used to be a time when it was okay to litter. Now people will actually call on you if you drop a piece of paper. So I think in terms of sexism and racism, we should actually strive for the same types of changes and work through our behaviors. But let me address, I think, an important question that you ask in terms of blind evaluations. What are they able to fix? And importantly, what can they not fix? So in my book, I specifically try to talk about both talent management and later stages in someone's careers, including how we redesign our work environments and how we design our teams. So I don't think we can rest on our laurels once we have introduced blind evaluations. That's just the first step. And then we have to think really, really hard about how we change what you call culture, what I would translate into our practices and procedures, how we form our teams, who speaks up when, how we use, small nudges to make it easier for all of us to do things right. And in terms of the, entry level that you also mentioned, we do see a closing of the gender gap at the entry level, including in STEM fields, so including in fields where women have traditionally been underrepresented. But what we to date have not been seeing is a closing of the gender gap at the top.
What you really are advocating here is from top to bottom, if you will, doing as much as one can to diminish gender bias in hiring, in evaluating, and in promoting.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And promotion is a very important place for us to look, because, again, that's a place where we see quite a bit of gender gaps.
Looking at some listener comments here, Daniel writes, this is going to sound strange, but unless you've been a man sitting in a room full of women waiting to apply for WIC, you haven't experienced gender bias. I personally don't know anyone who denies that women live with gender bias every day, but I know many women who routinely deny that men experience it.
Oh, I totally believe it. And I think nobody should deny that, again, people encounter stereotypical roles, or people who are in the minority in a given moment will experience bias. No question in my mind.
Here's Julian who writes, we can use the tendency to see bias in others. When I notice I'm criticizing someone else, I check myself. Usually it turns out I do the very thing I'm criticizing. It doesn't take long to make this a habit. And let me bring another caller on here. And Marie, that's you. Welcome. You're on the air.
Oh, hi, Michael. Great topic. I'm wondering if there is any research on some of the origins of this bias in terms of family of origin, or if a person, particularly facing women, if they are impacted by their domestic situation. For instance, I see a lot in high tech that many of the executives are married with, you know, wives, partners that are at home full-time, handling all the domestic front responsibilities. And I do wonder if there's any research showing how that could shape their perception of women.
Thank you for that, Marie. And let me go back to Iris Bonnet.
Marie, great question. I have a number of answers here. One is absolutely, it does matter. And in fact, we have really good evidence from research, from creative research, which tried to find a matrilineal society in the world to see whether what we see in the United States is more generalizable or whether it actually has to do with our cultural norms and our upbringing. And they went to the Kasi in India, a matrilineal society, where they found that women among the Kasi were more self-confident and more willing to take risks and more likely to compete than their male counterpart, which is exactly the reverse of what we find in the United States. So, yes, these norms clearly matter. But we don't have to go to the Kasi. I mean, we can also look in this country. So mothers who work outside of the home can be shown to be role models, not just for their daughters, but also for their sons. And let me add one more thing, which you didn't mention, but it's actually quite important. Some of our biggest allies are fathers of daughters. There is very good research showing that CEO, fathers of daughters, judges, and politicians who have daughters behave quite differently because they have daughters and care about them.
Good place to end. Thank you very much for being with us. Iris Bonnet's new book is What Works? Gender Equity, Equality, excuse me, by Design. She'll be 6 o'clock at the Mechanics Institute Library this evening. Thank you for being a part of our program. We appreciate your being with us. And for all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.